This is episode number 47 of The Big Web Show. This is a show where we talk about topics like web publishing, art direction, content strategy, typography, web technology, and more. It's everything web that matters. It is hosted by the creator of the internet, the godfather of the web, Mr. Jeffrey Zeldman, and me. I'm Dan Benjamin, and we would like to thank this episode for sponsoring the Intuit Small Business Blog. If you run a small business, medium-sized business, and you're at all interested in the details of running that business, if you care about things like online marketing and social media, this is the place to go, and you can read great articles just about this stuff. And now they've gone mobile. There is an iPhone app, an iPod Touch app, and of course, an iPad version. And you can find those things by going to blog.intuit.com or by searching for Intuit Blog in the iTunes App Store. I'd also like to thank Campaign Monitor. These guys are the ones that created Worldview. And whenever you send a newsletter, they'll show you on a map in real time when somebody opens it, when they click on a link to forward it to a buddy. They'll also show you who's liking it on Facebook or mentioning it on Twitter. You can go check out a live demo, campaignmonitor.com/worldview. And we'd also like to thank something that Jeffrey knows a little bit something about here. It's an event apart. This is the design conference for people who make websites. An event apart. I like this. Did you write this, Jeffrey?
I may have had a hand in it.
An event apart is an intensely educational two-day learning session for passionate practitioners of standards-based web design. If you care about code as well as content, usability as well as design, an event apart is the conference you've been waiting for. They have shows in Boston, Atlanta, Minneapolis, D.C., San Francisco. Find out more at aneventapart.com.
Wow, you read that like your brother wrote it.
He did. And it's easy to talk about something you love.
Well, thank you very much. And I love the speaker we have lined up for today. This is called Banter, right?
Yes.
Professional podcasters,
that is
call
correct.
This Banter.
You are correct.
Yeah. It's Food Spotting founder Alexa Andrzejewski, née Weber, or Lady Lexi, as she's better known on the internet, on Twitter. Ampersand Lady Lexi. She is a user experience designer, UX, IA, all that good stuff. Originally at Adaptive, well, I don't know about originally, but I know she got pretty famous at
really
Adaptive
famous.
Path.
Yeah.
At Adaptive Path, where she redesigned MySpace and conducted research into the technology that underlines the POM pre. And then, like a lot of people, a lot of talented people, she left to create a startup. Her startup you may have heard of is called Food Spotting. It's one of my favorite apps on the iPhone. It's not just an iPhone app, of course. It's also a web app. It's a web community. I'm sure it is also an app on other platforms, but I have only used it on the web and on the iPhone, and it is so visually beautiful, as you would hope a food app, you know, something related to the aesthetic pleasure of healthy, delicious eating would be. So, Alexa, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be here today.
And you're in San Francisco today?
I am in San Francisco, and it's beautiful.
In your company?
Yes, I'm at our newish office in SoMa.
For those who don't know, SoMa is south of Market, which is like the hot startup
area. That's where you want to be.
That's where you want to be.
Oh, yeah.
Right? It's near the Palace Hotel, I believe.
Yes, a bit south of that, near the ballpark. And if you walk around outside, you'll inevitably run into other startup people. If you eat at a cafe, you're probably going to hear someone pitch their startup to an investor. And everyone's pretty modest about it. There's not really signs saying, like, Twitter lives here or whatever.
Is that Second Avenue that goes right up to the ballpark like that? Is that where you guys are?
Second Street,
right.
Between Second and Third Street.
That's a great location. I worked for a startup a few years, maybe 3 years ago, that was right there on Second. Yeah, that was great. You go there. We just one day, lunchtime, let's just walk to the park, see if we can get in. Got in, watched 30, 45 minutes of a ball game. Went back to work.
Exactly.
It was great.
Yeah, and where our office is actually right, you can see the corner of the back of Adaptive Path from the Food Spotting office. Which is kind of interesting. So,
and where you are, I mean, there's a few, Seattle, New York, there's a few places. There's the internet's all over. You can have a great internet company anywhere. But there are a few places that are hubs, and San Francisco, perhaps the most famous hub of all. Basically, you walk down the street, right, and you're going to run into Ev Williams from, formerly from just about everything, right, from Twitter and Blogger, and I forget what other. I think he invented the Sun also, and right, and there's Jeff Veen from Typekit, and then you run into Matt Mullenweg from WordPress, and it's just like, and the people who fund that stuff, I mean, and every once in a while, someone may get so rich from their startup that they stop making their product and they just start funding other people. It's this bizarre ecosystem that is the envy of the world. And how did you get into all that? Are you originally from San Francisco?
No, I'm actually from Pittsburgh, like I think you are too.
Pittsburgh represent, that's right.
Yeah, we're all that's Pennsylvanians right here, all three of us.
That's all right, you from Philadelphia?
Yeah.
Yeah, my co-founder's from Philadelphia, so.
Awesome.
There we go.
Pennsylvania natives.
I'm liking where we're going with this.
Yeah. went to Ohio State, grew up in the kind of Midwest, and then moved out to San Francisco with my husband, who was doing city planning. And that's what originally brought me out here. But I also realized, you know, it was a great place to get a design job because I actually studied design in school.
Where was that?
A lot of people who get into the field. At Ohio State. I went to Ohio State.
I haven't heard of their design. I mean, there are good teachers everywhere. I hadn't heard of their design program. Was it like a general, like a graphic design program or a...
No, it was actually one of the design? Few visual communication design programs in the country. That's really great. And it focused on user-centered design from the beginning. So I mean, it was a broad program. So you could come out of that program going into everything from branding to typography, to interaction design. And interaction was just a part of that. But then my professor there helped me get my first job, which was at a company called Lextant in Columbus, which was a user-centered design, interaction design, and research company.
Who were your teachers?
Brian Stone and Paul Nini were some of my most memorable professors that set me off on the right foot, thinking about everything from the user's perspective, whether it was a logo design or typography design to interface design.
That is great. And this would be, what, in the late 90s, early O's?
I would say mid-2000s.
Mid-2000s.
Graduated in 2005 from undergrad.
Okay. Wait, so you were in college like 5 years ago, and now you're the founder of this huge company.
I guess you could say that. It was that short ago, I guess.
Wow. That's, I don't know whether to be joyous for you or sad for myself, but anyway, that's great. Help us understand that journey. You're in school, you're working in a place in Columbus, a user-centered design place. How do you make the leap to Adaptive Path? How did you hear about Adaptive Path, or how did they hear about you? What happened there?
So it was kind of funny. I moved out to San Francisco because my husband went to Berkeley and I was just, you know, off to find a job. And I actually continued to work for Lextant while I was in San Francisco for a little while. And then I actually wasn't one of those people that was like an Adaptive Path fan girl. I had actually not heard a lot about it, although I'd certainly read Jesse James Garrett's Ajax article because he's the one famous for coining that, of course. But I wasn't necessarily like hadn't been following Adaptive Path like a lot of people. But, you know, out of the blue, I got another agency in San Francisco, which made me kind of look around and see, you know, well, if I could get that job, you know, what could I get the job that I really want? Researched a bunch of companies. And when I saw Adaptive Path's website, I just knew that that was the place that I wanted to be. And I remember telling people, like, you know, I want this more than anything. Please pray that this works out when I applied there, because it didn't even look like Adaptive Path hired junior designers. Like, it looked like it was all these, you know, celebrity web people that had 10 years or more of experience. And it actually turned out to be
Tom Cruise. There,
but it turned out, yeah, exactly.
People like that.
People whose faces were plastered on books and on the wall, like Jeff Veen and everybody. So I wasn't sure that they even hired junior designers, but I went out on a limb and reached out to somebody there. I actually looked at everyone's photo, which they published up on the Adaptive Path site, and reached out to the person who looked the nicest.
No kidding.
It turned out to be Dan Saffer, the
He is nice. But they're all nice. They're all nice. But
he's from Pittsburgh as well.
He looked the nicest. And when you say he looked the nicest, do you mean he looked the friendliest, the least threatening?
The least threatening.
It's the glasses. He's just these giant glasses, right? And
indeed. And it's funny because Dan Safra always says people criticize his presentations because he doesn't smile enough and things like that. But so I picked him, reached out to him, and
you don't smile when you present either.
I know. I need to work on that.
I don't do that either. It's okay.
You know,
it's okay. The people paid good money to hear you. There's nothing to smile about. Just get that educational material out.
Sometimes when I go up there, I just like to just smile.
Learning.
I just look around and smile for a while until people get a little creeped out. Then I know it's time to talk.
Smile like an idiot, you mean?
Just smile and look at people. Point to, do you ever point to somebody? I haven't been to one of these an event apart things. Do you ever just sort of point to somebody like a Paul Newman thing? Just kind of point and wink a little bit. Someone out there in the audience.
Alexa was totally like that. She had her own entrance music.
I guess I was the only presenter who didn't dance when I entered.
That's true.
Is that real?
It was a strange show. Yes, all the presenters were dancing. It's true. Luke Rabluski got the entire audience dancing. Time Coates danced. Everyone danced.
I made up for
Eric Meyer danced, which we really didn't need to see. That wasn't something we wanted to see. But Alexa, who I've told is a fantastic dancer, did not dance.
Yes, I didn't. I missed the memo on that. But I made up for it by singing karaoke after with all the other speakers.
This is what I heard. I was in my room crying, but it's okay. So you get to Adaptive Path and work with Dan Safra. Were you in a tiny cog in a large machine, or did they throw you at big projects? How did that work?
No, so I started on projects right away. So I was their first kind of junior designer, quote unquote, but, right away they give everybody a lot of responsibility and ownership of everything there. That's kind of like a design co-op in the sense that everybody feels a lot of ownership of what they're doing. All the teams are small, three, four people. And I worked on some interesting projects while I was at Adaptive Path, some of the ones that you mentioned.
What did you do for the Palm Tree?
Yeah, I was going to ask that too.
Roger Black also did a lot of work on Palm Tree. Maybe a different time. I know his company worked on the typography.
Interesting.
Did you work on the design of the platform, the experience of the platform itself, or what did you work on?
So what I actually worked on was design principles that were guiding principles for the Palm Prix and the organization apps in particular on the Palm Prix. So I worked with their research team to go out and actually study how people organize their lives. And it was like this 2-week-long in-depth ethnography study of all the different ways people organize things. And we looked at the piles on their desks and the piles under the bed and the way that they would put things in front of their door so they'd trip over them so they'd remember. And learned a lot about just how people, organize their lives according to context and all of that. And we had like Merlin Mann come in, for example, and was focusing on how people organize their lives and how the Palm Pre could support that.
Is that the kind of research that you typically do? I imagine right now you with your own product.
Yeah. So, a lot of Adaptive Path research and then, the kind of informal research we've done for food spotting is just observing people's existing behaviors and not focusing on, testing your, not focusing first on like showing people an idea, but just seeing how they currently do things and what the pain points are. And getting ideas from that. And that's really what a lot of the focus of the research was at Adaptive Path, was this kind of generative idea, generating research that would yield generally design principles that could then guide decision making when you're moving into product design. So that was what was, really important as a focus there.
And that may explain the simplicity of food spotting, but it doesn't explain the uncanny beauty of food spotting. I really think this is like one of the most beautiful apps I've seen. And I'm,
you see a lot of apps.
I do. And I'm pretty particular. So who's responsible for what we used to call the look and feel?
Well, I actually have done all of the visual design for food spotting myself, which is funny because I don't actually consider myself to be a visual designer or a visual design expert. Because I focused on user experience and I was doing, you know, wireframing and interaction design flows and all of that. But, food spotting, you know, we've been looking at bringing on visual designers, but till now it's been all me and my co-founder, Ted, who's also very visually working on the site and the app. So it's been an interesting learning experience. And I think you never learn design.
I think judging from this, I would say you're a very good designer and I would be visual designer and I'd be reluctant to bring in anyone else. You might lose something. The typography, the positioning of the icons, the design of the icons, the little hierarchy, I mean, all those touches, the where you are, the simple background, the way photos load on it. If you're listening to this podcast and you haven't downloaded it, you hadn't signed up for food spotting or downloaded this app, I urge you to do it. It's really a beautiful, simple, elegant, mesmerizing visual experience. And, you know, all you have to do is come and no offense, you know, I love Yelp. I think Yelp does some amazing stuff. There are things Yelp, but you know, if you compare the experience of registering, you know, what you're eating here with something like Yelp, I mean, there's no comparison. The user experience and the visual experience in food spotting is just so wonderful. Go ahead.
We're really focused on creating this inherently mobile experience of finding the things in the world around you.
Right.
And the design, the way that it's laid out, the way that the photos scroll horizontally even, is more focused on, you know, less looking at a hierarchical list of results or search results and more about discovery and stumbling upon something. So we really try to, you know, create that experience in the app that you're just browsing, like almost looking in a bakery window through a lens or looking through a viewmaster and discovering interesting things around you. And that's the experience that we, you know, have been trying to create and are always trying to improve. And, you know, that's the main kind of experience goal that we have.
Now, how did you evolve this visual experience? What was the method? What was the inspiration? You said ViewMaster. Were you actually playing with the ViewMaster? Or did you and your partner talk about metaphors? Or were you sitting there in Photoshop? Were you sketching? How did this evolve? How did this come about? I think this is, again, this is a great visual interface. I wish I'd designed it. This is the kind of thing, when things like this come out of our company, I'm really happy. And I just wonder how you got there.
Yeah, well, when I first started out prototyping the ideas for food spotting, the way that food spotting began was it was just an idea that I kept in head and I was working on it solo, trying to communicate the idea so I could find a co-founder who was technical. And so my very first sketches and mockups of the idea looked like a Yelp for dishes, list view, star ratings, you know, all the things you'd expect to see in a review app. And I show those to people. They're like, oh, this is nice. It's kind of boring. It doesn't quite get at the experience of food or sharing those experiences around food. I would actually print out all of my wireframes and put them in a little deck, like a little deck of cards, and carry that around with me. And so when I was eating dinner with people, I'd pull it out and be like, you know, hey, what do you think of using this, you know, app for finding food, and have them go through the little deck of cards. And eventually, I got the feedback that, you know, what if I made this really a lot more focused on the photos? And it was actually Megan Casey from Squidoo. She's the founder of Squidoo. Who, said this in a way that it hit me, which was that, you know, what if I make the design focused on the visual? And I'd always thought that the photos were important. I always thought about the idea of having people share recommendations through photos. But the idea of making them front and center and then requiring them was a bigger kind of revolutionary step. And that was pretty early on. It was still just me kind of prototyping ideas. But I went back and completely redesigned it. So it was like you were looking at a stack of cards that were these photos of things near you and just, you know, using it as this visual discovery engine. And it was really through talking to people and getting feedback that idea came about. It was also influenced a lot by my work at Adaptive Path because we did a lot of things with metaphors. One of the interesting exercises that we did at Adaptive Path was a make-believe exercise. And this was for a mobile client. that was brainstorming ideas for the mobile device of the future.
Which mobile client?
I actually can't name the client, but it was, you know, it was actually their R&D group that was focusing on, you know, thinking towards the future and where mobile's headed.
Mm-hmm.
So my colleague, Kate Rutter from Adaptive Path, came up with this exercise where she brought in like this huge pile of random junk from her home. So there are things like magnifying glasses, lenses, viewmasters, magic flowers, all kinds of weird objects.
Magic flowers.
Affordances.
Okay.
Magic flowers are these like red paper, crepe paper flowers that you turn inside out and it turns into a flower. Some people remember them. Like
you,
science
do you drop them in water?
No, it's different from that. But you know, she could have brought something like that as well. Altoids tins was another one. And then she gave everybody these objects and said, I want you to go out in the world, walk around the neighborhood, go to lunch, go shopping, you know, spend the afternoon walking around the neighborhood with your random object, pretending that it is the mobile device of the future. And so, you know, some people had a box of Altoids and that was their future mobile device. And they would act out things like collecting information and putting it into the Altoids, little tidbits of information. And some people had things that were more like a magic wand, and they would point it at things to control them, like to call a cab or to check in so their friends would know where they were. And this was before, you know, location-based services or all of these solutions were coming out. But a lot of the ideas were, you know, really close related to what's happening today. And the biggest idea that came out of that was magnifying lenses. And the object that I had was kind of like a magnifying glass or coaster thing that you could look through. And the thing was that if you were looking through this thing, you could see more things about the world around you. And it's kind of this augmented reality thing. But what I realized is that it doesn't look like a reality. That's their glasses. It could just be this experience that's like having your senses augmented, which food spotting really is. Like when you turn on food spotting, you're seeing things that are around you that you wouldn't have seen with your bare eyes otherwise. It's like a lens. On the world that just sees food and where to find it.
Right, but you don't overdo it. You don't.
Right. So not a literal interpretation of that lens metaphor, but like the spirit of the lens, which is that, you know, it's this thing that augments your senses of what's around you.
Question coming in from the chat room here. Did this come from a passion for culinary experiences? Are you a big foodie? They're just kind of curious as to all of that.
So the way that food spotting came about was it was inspired by a trip to Japan. I went to Japan the first time a few years ago and learned about all these just interesting dishes that I had never heard of before. And I've always been, you know, open to trying new foods and curious about new foods, but I'd never really considered myself a foodie. Just curious about the foods that are out there. And when I was in Japan, there were so many new things there that I just never had seen or heard about in the U.S. And it really opened my eyes to just how many new foods are out there that people don't know about growing up in the Midwest or where I grew up. And I wanted to create a way for people to learn about the foods that are out there. So my original idea was actually to create a book that would be a food guide, like a bird guide only for food. But then I shared that idea with people. You know, people love the book idea, but they really wanted an app that would show them interesting foods and then show them where to find them locally. And alongside that was kind of the frustration that I realized that, you know, if there was a food that I discovered, for example, okonomiyaki is a dish I discovered in Osaka. There was no way to search for that food locally because there was just not much structured data around specific dishes and where to find the best version of that. And so that's how the idea for food spotting came out about. It really evolved from this book idea, which I was actually actively trying to write a pitch for. I might still do someday. But that then evolved into this app idea for finding dishes. And then I realized there was no way to find dishes. And so I realized to do that, we needed to build up this collection of all the dishes out there and where to find them.
It's so much better as an app than it would have been as a book. No offense.
Yeah.
Go ahead and write that book. I love books. We all love books. But, you know, I mean, passively reading a book of beautiful photos of someone's Caesar salad with salmon, not the same thing. Right. And you know, one of the things... There are books to explore cities, right? We've all had the experience like 5, 10 years, like you went to Japan. So 5, 10 years ago, you'd go someplace and you'd maybe bring a rough guide with you. And it would be this wonderful little book that you'd pull out of your backpack or your purse and flip through and go, oh, I think I'm in this section. Or There's the A to Z books in London, right, where they have they've taken the London map and divided it into millions of pieces that you fold
right.
That are like, but none of these things compare to the mobile experience, which is so much more immediate and knows where you are. And you don't have to go, you don't have to look up in an almanac, oh, I think we're on Charing Cross Road. I wonder what part of, you know, none of that nonsense, right? Not that it's nonsense, but you don't have to
I know, exactly. I think, and one of the things that, there's been a lot of frustrations that have evolved their way into food spotting. And one of those was that, like, when you read, that's like, you know, here are some dishes that you must try in San Francisco. A famous one is this 100 things to try before you die list that right. a local magazine came out with. When you read that in a magazine, it's just so frustrating because you don't know which of those things are nearby at a given time. You never know what the locations are, so you can't actually act on that list very easily without looking all those places up. So one of the things we've actually been really trying to do is help publishers take their static content and make it available on the mobile and based on your context and location. So one of the things that publishers can do is actually take lists of food and publish them, you know, as easy as making a list on our site. And then people can find those guides on the iPhone app and on the website and on the other mobile apps. And then see, you know, which of the 7x7, 100 things to try before you die are actually close to me. And it's just like little frustrations like that and little things we can do to make them better that have, you know, been some of the best ideas in food spotting.
Have any couples gotten together because they met through, I mean, because in a way, I mean, certainly you can go to like OkCupid or Match.com if you're single and looking for somebody, but maybe you're not, maybe you don't want to do that, but maybe you keep on turning up at certain restaurants and seeing these great foods. It's like, oh, I love red velvet cake too. Oh, I love vegetarian soup too. Oh, and who took this picture? And it's always the same person. Any scary stories?
I don't think I can think of a
nothing
scary
that you know
story.
About?
It's funny, there's a, but one of my fellow 500 startups is actually doing a site called Spoon Date, which is actually
Spoon Date or Spoon yes. Bait?
Spoon Date. Spoon Date.
I still can't get it because we're having like
S-P-O-O-N-D-A-T-E, Spoon Date.
Date. Spoon Date.
And the idea, and she might actually be playing around with our API, is by taking your list of things that you want and the list of things someone else wants and pairing you up based on things you want to try together. And so it's interesting that the food spotting and other apps have inspired some ideas around dating around food for real. I think I'm really curious about that. And then for us, we've actually found potential employees and contractors through food spotting by seeing some of the people who are just posting amazing photos and reaching out to them, inviting them to our events, and eventually realizing, hey, this is a designer.
Is anyone using it to publicize a restaurant, or to publicize their photography? Is anyone cheating, in other words, in your community in some way, you know, using it as a marketing tool rather than as a community thing, or would you not care how people
use
it?
We actually, like, our goal and our vision is to catalog all the dishes that are out there and where to find them. And we don't mind if a restaurant's the first to publish their own dishes up on the site. And actually, we would love it if they would, because it makes it easier for then you to go in and just rate the dish without taking a photo of it yourself. We have a game mechanic.
I was just going to ask, I know you support Foursquare, which is great. I wonder if you're going to support Gowalla anytime.
We actually would love to support Gowalla. When we were building those integrations, they didn't have a write API. But I'm actually a passionate Gowalla user myself. Would love to have that in there as well.
Well, that's almost in a way, it seems like food spotting is a big part of what people use something like Gowalla for. I mean, a lot of the time people are you know, sharing their locations, whether it's with Foursquare or Gowalla. A lot of the time what you see is, oh, I'm here eating this. And
right.
It seems like I wouldn't want to call this a more focused version of Gowalla, but there are a lot of things in common. Do you think this is the natural evolution of that kind of thing? Do you think we'll see more apps that are, I'm buying this here, or, you know, I'm watching this. There are apps that are not just sort of general, I'm here doing this, but I'm here eating this, or I'm here watching this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you should mention that, because I was just at the Wear 2.0 conference speaking alongside Tara Hunt, who just launched Biosphere, which is a website for sharing things that you're buying.
Wait a minute, she changed the name?
Oh, possibly.
We had her on the show.
Yeah, it was called something. What was that called?
Yeah.
What was the old name of that? See, that's a problem if we don't remember. Neither of us remembers it.
It's okay. All you need to remember now is Biosphere with B-U-Y.
Right. It's totally different. You know, wow, it looks completely different.
You know, between Biosphere and Pinterest, and then there's Ditto, which is by another user experience person that I really respect, which is Yuri Engelstrom. Ditto is about sharing what you're about to do or eat, or what you're about to watch, and then letting people give you recommendations in real time. And I think that, you know, this moving to this level of just granularity is what we did with food spotting, which is like, you know, we're saying it's not about the restaurant, it's about the food and what's actually good at the restaurant. And that's what people seem to post about anyway on Yelp and Foursquare and things like that.
Yeah, to me they're different. Yeah,
it's different use cases. I mean,
yes.
I use Yelp when I'm looking for a great place to bring a large group or to have a party or, you know, things like that.
I would use them both, but I would use Yelp and food spotting. Just food spotting is more personal. I would celebrate with food spotting. I would use Yelp for information and research, and then I would use food spotting to like revel in the wonderful meal that we had, and then I would log it. I would check in on Gowalla and Foursquare.
Right, exactly. You know. I mean, I think it's just great.
I wouldn't have time to actually have a dinner conversation. I would speak.
You'd just be checking in and sharing what you're doing.
The autistic man-child.
I've been to dinner with you. Mm. So, you know, if your Gowalla posts in real time as we eat.
What kind of server do you have going? I mean, do you have your own, like, millions of racks of servers to handle the traffic, and do you have problems? Are there issues?
Because we've been doing a major server upgrade all week. So if you're trying to go to food spotting right this second, it may be a little flaky.
In fact, I was uploading. I took a picture at lunch using Camera Plus, and I signed in to the lunch place at Gowalla, but I was waiting to do the food spotting thing until I was talking to you, and I was while we've been chatting, I've been doing it, but it seems like it's taking a long time. It seems like
upgrading our entire app. It's built in Ruby on Rails, so upgrading everything. We're hosted in the cloud, like most web apps these days, which is generally working out well for all of us. Except the other day, Amazon's EC2 went down, bringing down a lot of sites that we use, like Twitter and Foursquare and a bunch of others. So you know, there's downsides to that as well.
But Flickr also seems to be having trouble these days. Are you all in the same cloud? Is it the cloud on Second Street in South of Market? What's going on there? Is it Jeff Veen's basement? What's going on?
yeah, I don't know where the cloud lives. For all I know, it's up in the sky. At the end of a series of tubes. But
how did you and your partner go from we have this neat idea and here's, you know, to a funded actual thing with millions of users, right?
Because
how did you go from we have this neat idea to here you are and you're the CEO of your own company and you have a million users and you're in the cloud?
Right. So it's funny. So I never was, there are a lot of people out here who are working at agencies working at companies that are like, you know, someday I'm going to leave and start my own company. And that's their aspiration. And they don't know what it is, but they're just going to leave and start their own company someday. And for me, I wasn't necessarily one of those people. I mean, I loved working at Adaptive Path and,
in your spare time. You did food spotting as just
as a side project, which was just, you know, me exploring this book idea, then this app idea, you know, vetting the mock-ups and wireframes and all of that. But I began to realize as the more people I talked to that in order to make this big and to really achieve this goal of cataloging all these foods and where to find them, you know, a couple of things needed to happen. I needed to build a team or find a co-founder, several co-founders, in fact, that could execute and make this thing real. In order to do that, we needed money. And so I realized, oh, well, I guess I got to go learn how to raise money for a startup. And, you know, in order to do that, we need to be a corporation. And like, it was kind of like, well, I've got this idea that I really want to make real and I want to figure out how to do it. And it turns out that, you know, to do it in a big way, we needed all this, you know, needed to learn how to build a company from scratch.
How did you do that? Did you have, were there people there, like, were there mentors, people who reached out to you and said, don't worry, here's who you talk to, here's what you do? I mean, there's a lot of people listening to this show who have ideas that may be just as good, but they don't they don't know what to do with them.
I mean, I was kind of in that place too, right, where I first had the idea and was like, you know, well, I'm a user experience designer, so I can't actually build this thing. So now what? And what was funny was when I first started out, I looked around at my circles and I realized that everybody I knew in my professional network was in user experience design. So everyone was also a designer, and nobody in my networks could build anything that I wanted, you know, and wouldn't make a good co-founder for food spotting. So that was the first like realization was like, whoa, I need to get out of this bubble and go meet people in other circles. And it's funny because like the startup community and the design community don't intersect intersect surprisingly little, it seems like sometimes.
Right.
Like the people who are speaking at an event apart are really different than the people who are speaking at Web 2.0 or where a lot of times.
And it's we pay.
Yeah, I know. That difference too.
There's that difference right there.
Definitely makes a big difference. But it's funny, like it's a different crowd.
Right.
And I realized, in order to build a startup, these crowds needed to intersect. So I started tapping, you know, the people who'd left Adaptive Path to do their own startups first, who then, you know, introduced me to a few other people. And the big moment came when I met somebody who had been like me and had an idea and then went to a startup weekend, which is you know, this great organization where you can get together with people for a weekend, share your idea, and find some people to help prototype it or test it out. And so she had an idea, brought it to Startup Weekend, and actually formed a team and was working on this idea full time. And that was when I had this like epiphany that, wow, ordinary people like me can make their ideas real by starting a startup, by starting a company. And so I joined Startup Weekend and I went to Women 2.0, which is another kind of program for learning the 101 of startup in San Francisco. And Startup Weekends are around the world, and Women 2.0, I think, is worldwide as well. And so these resources are not just in San Francisco. But through that, I really made the connections that we need to turn this into a company. That's where I met, you know, the angel investor who first introduced us to, you know, other investors.
Does that mean they're dead? Lawyers. I keep hearing about these angel investors. How does that work? What makes them angels?
They're those people mentioned earlier who made a lot of money and now they can just go funding other people's companies. So
why did that not take a vacation or something? I mean, what's the incentive or the interest for them to do that? Just because they want to stay in it? They want to stay involved?
There's a lot of reasons, I think. But I do think a lot of it is like, you know, it's a way to give back, of course. So, I mean, all of us, I think, realize that we wouldn't be where there's no way I would be where I am now with food spotting if it weren't for people who took the time to have coffee with me. And, you know, I wasn't, you know, anybody at the time, really. Not that I'm anybody now either, but like, you know, people who took the time out of their busy lives and schedules to mentor me, you know, these angel investors have had those people too and realized that, you know, they can give back financially and mentoring other people to create great companies. So, you know, there's a thrill in that too, which is, you know, being able to feel like you're part of these new companies that are starting up and a lot more companies than you could by yourself. And we're really thankful. We actually had like 12 angel investors in our first round. So we're really thankful for these people.
Some of the people in the chat room were asking a few questions that specifically were wondering how many users, and you know, these are kind of touchy questions people don't always want to answer, but maybe if you can't talk about that, we'll ask, maybe you can, but if you can't talk about how many users, you know, what kind of growth have you seen, and what was that in relationship to? In other words, have you seen spikes in the growth? Have you seen sudden increases? Has it been gradual? And how have you responded to that kind of growth as far as both what you've been building in the user experience, but also behind the scenes having to, you know, maybe add more resources or expand your infrastructure?
Right, definitely. Well, a lot of, I think that for food spotting, growth has, you know, it started out slow and steady. It wasn't, you know, it was a new thing to people, and not everybody, you know, took pictures of their food already and would be a contributor and things like that. And I remember, you know, we got our first 3,000 users and we were so happy. But now, you know, we've been able to scale the iPhone app downloads up to, you know, over 800,000, and the Android app has over 50,000 downloads, and we just launched it at South by Southwest. And, you know, I think a lot of the growth has come through a couple of things. The first has really been these great local content partnerships, which is like with 7x7 magazines, 100 Things to Try Before You Die, and then the Travel Channel, who put all of Anthony Bourdain's recommendations on food spotting. So if you're ever traveling,
that didn't hurt.
You know, he ate. Yeah, that didn't hurt at all. And they also did TV ads. I think what's been surprising.
How do you find that? Okay, so again, somebody else has some, not a food, not a competitor, but somebody else has something. How do you go from I've got this cool app to Anthony Bourdain or the equivalent, you know, on Bravo or the Travel Channel or something? How do you make those deals? Do you have a person, a marketing person who does this information? Who on your staff located them, or did they find you? How does that work?
Right. So we actually do have a team of people devoted to partnerships and outreach. We have two people that are dedicated to building community, Amy and Fiona. They're community managers in San Francisco and New York. And one person who's dedicated to business development and partnerships. And they are the most amazing executors I've ever worked with. But I think one of the things that I really want to bring up here that I've learned is that the behind every one of these biggest successes for food was a concrete vision or a concrete user experience vision.
Okay.
Something I talk about a lot is like if you can communicate an idea in a concrete, contagious, simple way, that's when something happens. Like I literally say, you know, if you can dream it, you can do it. And if I can picture something in a really concrete way and sum it up in like one statement or one challenge, my team
So if you got a couple of comps and a sentence or two that can communicate and make it infectious.
Exactly. So I mean, the way that the Anthony Bourdain thing was that I literally said, you know, one of my dreams for food spotting is to be able to turn on food spotting and see where the nearest places Anthony Bourdain has eaten wherever I go. Because I was just in Japan, I ate a place where Anthony Bourdain ate. And so I told my co-founder Soraya that, and I said, you know, Soraya, I really want to be able to see Anthony Bourdain's recommendations, the nearest ones, wherever I go. And literally that week, she went out and she was having dinner with the president of the Travel Channel. And she didn't even know anybody there, but she was able to execute on this vision and make this thing happen literally within a month. And the Travel Channel is big. I mean, these organizations are generally pretty slow to work with, but, you know, everyone got that idea. Like, yeah, it would be great to be able to see where Bourdain eats wherever you go. And that's how it really happened.
It's good for them, right? It's good for them. It's good for their show. It's good for their brand.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, even food spotting began with this, like, vision statement. If you look for my UX-driven startup presentation, you'll see actually what I began, like, what food spotting began as, which was, like, a one-page poster with a series of little cartoon sketches that I did showing what the experience of using food spotting would be like. And these were just, you know, so whether it's like a simple sketch saying like, here's me, you know, finding what my friends recommend at every restaurant, or having a picture menu for every restaurant, or whether it's a metaphor like saying food spotting is like a lens that lets you only see food, or a compass that only points north. Whenever you can articulate an idea.
I like the first one better.
depends if you're a Pirates of the Caribbean fan. But by like concrete, articulating things in this really concrete way, they'll happen. I've actually read a whole article about this, because everything that's happened with food spotting has had some concrete idea behind it. And one of those was like, you know, we want to have 500,000 users by the end of the year. And, you know, things that was something the whole team could rally around, and it, you know, captures the team's imagination. And I like to talk about, you know, the book Made to Stick, which I'm sure a lot of you guys know about.
Made to Stick. Who's the author?
It's by Chip and Dan Heath. I believe.
Chip and Dan Heath?
Yes, Made to Stick.
Chip and Dan Heath.
And I hope that's right, because sometimes I flake out on authors' names. But what he talks about is how John F. Kennedy's call to put a man on the moon and return him safely by the end of the decade was the perfect example of that actionable, concrete vision. he wasn't talking about business goals or, you know, this lofty mission statement. He was just giving this concrete image of putting a man on the moon and returning and making it really concrete by the end of the decade. And, you know, this nation or this vision captured the nation's imagination and made it happen. And I'm finding that to be so true with food plotting.
And madetostick.com is where you could find that, although they've now moved to heathbrothers.com, which says it's undergoing maintenance, which is sad. So, but if you go to madetostick.com and ignore their invitation to go to heathbrothers.com instead, but just stay at madetostick.com, you can actually read about the book. And no,
it
you
has
can't.
Some other
you click on the book, you get back to heathbrothers.com, which is undergoing maintenance. So they don't know about websites, but they do know about ideas. and I remember that. Like, we will send a man to the moon, not because it is easy, but because it is hard. I wasn't trying to do the voice, but yeah, it was phenomenal. And ask not what you can do for your country. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for you. I've been waiting all my life for you know, leaders to inspire me that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you inspire your team in the same way, you can, you know, it sounds like when you hire people, you look for people who can communicate. Not just
absolutely.
The marketing people, but the developers, the designers, is the ability to write and speak a prerequisite. If I want to work with you, if I'm going, wow, I love food spotting. I love her vision. I love that sounds like a great company to work for. And I live in San Francisco. what skills do I need? I mean, besides design skills, is communication big?
Communication is huge, but I don't think you have to necessarily be a professional writer. You just have to be able to articulate an idea in a concrete way. And I really do look for, like, I mean, I think I took for granted while I was at Adaptive Path how many idea people there were. It's funny, at Adaptive Path, we took our Myers-Briggs profiles and every single one was N, you know, which I guess implies that N's are more of those creative idea people. And I don't necessarily think that's the case all of the time. But, like, I'm used to being around those idea people. And then, you know, going into hiring for food spotting, I realized, you know, not everybody is an ideas person. And that's not always, you know, finding people who can execute is equally as important. And I think that a lot of our team is really strong at executing. But finding people who can articulate an idea in a concrete way, you know, that's critical to sales, that's critical to design, that's critical to user experience, everything. And I think, you know, it's a skill that everybody can learn, for sure, yeah.
Some of the people in the chat room, Alex, were asking how you think about revenue stream this early on. Is it something that you have to, and I'm not saying for you to reveal your secret plans for revenue streams on the show, but is that something you think about? Is it something you have to present when you're taking investment, or is it simply these guys have a great idea we think they could get in front of a lot of people?
No, I mean, every investor we talked to wanted to know how this will make money, of course.
And right.
It's something we've thought about from the beginning because we want the way that we make money to be inherently related to what people are mainly using food spotting for. Like, we don't want to tack on a revenue model, you know, down the road. We want it to be related to the main goal, which is finding great food and where to find it. And, you know, so, I mean, it's not really a big secret that we're interested in is the vision of having you be able to turn on your device and not just see you know, user-generated content around you, but you can also see you know, a great talent on a certain dish at a restaurant nearby. Or you can see, you know, the special dish of the day that a restaurant's serving that you can't really learn about now because, you know, they write it up on their blackboard and you won't learn about it unless you go there. And so we're interested in how restaurants and local businesses can publish, you know, useful content and coupons and deals into this stream that are related to the goal of finding food. So, like, high quality, you know, offers on dishes or on food, things like that. You know, we'd love to put that stuff in the stream where when you're out looking for food, you turn on the app, you're hungry, you can find something that's likely to be interesting to you. And that's, I'm really excited about that because I think it's something that creates value for the user and creates value for the business and for food spotting as well. And so, I mean, I think that's what we ask ourselves for any potential revenue model or partnership is, you know, does it create value for the user first and foremost, then the business, and then for food spotting.
Right, because it's very important to protect your brand.
Absolutely.
It's more important than the money.
Yes. And especially at this early stage, you know, where we're, right. our goal is to play and see what works. And we're planning to test these ideas and see what works. And we're really fortunate to have venture backing, so we have time to experience.
At what point, though, at what point does that backing, which right now sounds great, at what point does that become, I don't want to use the term liability because that really generally has a negative connotation, but at what point does that become maybe a driving force in the way that you guys do business? In other words, I often hear people who are on the flip side of that, and we kind of touched on this a little bit, but I hear people on the flip side of that who are saying, well, no, wait until you're, you know, X size or until you've accomplished X, Y, Z or until you really need it. It seems like so often companies will take investment early. And on the one hand, you say, well, that makes sense because then they can get from, you know, A to Q really fast instead of going all those middle steps. I mean, what's the philosophy that drives you behind that? I think it's a question a lot of people who are starting businesses would love to hear you talk about.
Well, I mean, the philosophy behind taking money, I think, is, you know, don't just take the first thing that comes along because you don't know when the next thing will come. I mean, I think we, like for food spotting, we got some early offers from investors that, you know, it was very tempting to be like, you know, wow, we could now and but those particular investors weren't necessarily, like we hadn't, you know, talked to a lot of other investors. We didn't know if these were the best investors. And there's sometimes this temptation to kind of like jump and like take the easy route, I guess. Instead of doing kind of the due diligence that you need. But when picking investors, I mean, if we don't want our investors to be a liability, the most important thing up front is making sure that they are completely aligned with our goals and not trying to, you know, trick them into thinking we're heading in the direction they want just so we can get their money, but to really make sure, like, do they agree with our goals? Do they agree with our vision, the things that we're planning to focus on? And it's, you know, there can be a temptation to want to say what they want to hear so that you can get their money or things like that,
sure.
right? Or to take the easy route because it's like, well, this person wants to give me money. They're not the greatest fit, but I'll just take their money because it's there. But I think that, you know, without taking forever to make decisions, take the time to make sure that the investors or partners or hires or everybody are aligned with your vision. Otherwise, you'll end up, you know, wasting a lot of time, potentially falling apart because of the conflicts. And, you know, we're really lucky to have investors that, our lead investor, especially, that are aligned with the vision that we have for food spotting.
What else we got in the chat room, Dan?
You know, I think a lot of people are just really interested to hear how this comes together in the just kind of drawing from earlier questions, how it all comes together. I mean, you've talked about some of the aspects of it, but at the end of the day, what are people, and again, I'll throw this back out to what the general people who are listening to this are saying, you know, this sounds great because, you know, you're coming from this background of working with Adaptive Path. You've got all these great connections. You've got people because you're in downtown San Francisco. This is all great. You know, what about people who don't have these kinds of connections, who maybe have creative ideas and can put this out there? And time and time again, I know I won't mention who it is, but I have a friend who launched an app, and it's a great app, just having tons and tons and tons of trouble getting it in front of the right people, getting to talk about it, because they're not in San Francisco. You know, they can't call up somebody on the phone and you know, get a, I don't want to say a celebrity endorsement, but they can't do that. I mean, clearly those things are critical, right? But can you still have success without that in 2011?
I'll admit there's an unfair advantage to San Francisco. And in Columbus, there were as many talented designers and visionaries, but, you know, like I go there, I see people's great ideas and, you know, then I wonder, you know, why aren't I hearing about them? And there's an unfair advantage to the San Francisco ecosystem. But that said, I really do feel like the landscape is changing, and that there are people actively trying to create startup communities elsewhere. This time last year, I spoke at Big Omaha, which was a startup conference in Omaha, focused on building up Silicon Prairie.
Really?
Which is the network of, you know, Midwestern investors.
I've never heard of Silicon Prairie.
Yeah, there's actually the Silicon Prairie News Network or something. They do this Big Omaha, which is actually coming up really soon. And actually, if they're in the Midwest, I'd encourage you to check it out, because it was an amazing conference. I mean, Gary Vaynerchuk was there, Matt Malag was there. You know, a lot of web and tech celebrities were there. But the most important thing was the community was like you realize like you're not alone doing this startup in the Midwest. You know, there's a lot, there are people, there are investors, they're all out there. So I think that that culture is changing. And then the other big thing is just, I think a little bit more equal, like attempts to equalize access to investors. And one of the big ones is a site called AngelList, or a project called AngelList. That's where the founders let you pitch your idea to them. And then they'll, if they like your idea, they'll send it out to all of the major angel investors around the country that are a good fit. And I mean, for us, like we started when AngelList was just getting started. So we didn't necessarily use that model, but they helped us make intros. But I've heard that that's a great way for companies from around the country to get access to angel investors. And if you read on Quora, you know, there's lots of great things being said about AngelList, and the founders have been nothing but helpful. And then Startup Weekend. I mean, that's how I began with food spotting, is I took the idea to a Startup Weekend and I pitched it just along with everybody else, and you know, tried to find people who are interested in helping.
Where are those held besides them?
They're held around the country and around the world, actually. So if you look at their site, you know, they'll have a list of upcoming dates. You know, I definitely know this was in Columbus, Ohio, and Pittsburgh, you know, place that I've been. And you know, I'm really excited about what Startup Weekend's doing to encourage entrepreneurs around the country and around the world to get started and make those connections. And it was through a Startup Weekend that we met, you know, kind of this one person that became this hub of intros to investors, to lawyers, to everybody else. Like I said, I didn't have a network of startup people when I started out either. You know, I had a couple of connections through Adaptive Path, but a lot of those actually were still in the design world. And in order to get out of that, you know, a lot of it, I do credit Startup Weekend. And I'm fortunately, Startup Weekend is around the world.
Startupweekend.org is the city, and I'm sorry, is the website, and it is location aware.
Wow.
Which is pretty sweet. And if it can't recognize, for instance, if you're sitting at a desktop, then you can just click on a map to find your city. Pretty sweet. And so there are real people there who will listen and have money. Not that we really care about money. This is not about money, but this is about bringing your idea into the world and seeing if people love it and finding people who... So if you've got a great idea that you can articulate in a concrete way, that's what we learned today from listening to you. If you've got a great idea that you can articulate in a concrete way and you can draw it or sum it up in a couple of sentences or both, and you've got the right partner, not someone who does the same thing you do, not like three graphic designers, three UX designers, but a balanced team of people, you've got that. But you don't necessarily work in South of Market and don't have lunch next to billionaires who like to fund startups. That's okay. You can go to startupweekend.org, find out where a startup weekend's happening in your city, take that idea and pitch it and see what happens. Mm-hmm. I think that's great. I learned a lot today. I think I really appreciate your spending time with us today.
Me too. Where should people go to just cover all the bases with you, Alex?
Just an overview of something.
I mean, like Twitter, and you know, where are you?
So if you can follow me on Twitter at Lady L A D Y L E X Y, and you can also find everything else if you go to flavors.me/LadyLexi, flavors.me/LadyLexi. And you can find links to all my other profiles. And what I should post there are some links to some of the articles I've written for people getting started in startup. But if you search for UX-driven startup, you'll find some resources there that I did there, which has a lot of like
UX-driven startup?
Yeah. It's a slideshare presentation that's on Adaptive Path site and a couple of others.
There's also some Google will find some other... crafting more articly like things. Are you going to write anytime soon for like, let's say, List Apart or some other?
I could do that. The question about this idea of the concrete vision and the how that's driven everything. And
I found that so useful and so educational. It's going to change the way I work and talk to people. And I think if you could write that up as something, as a technique that people can share, I think that could be useful to others.
All right, I'd love to talk more about that.
Cool.
Cool, all right. Cool. Well, that about does it for this one. Alex, thanks so much for being here. Jeffrey, as always, thanks for being here. And people should really follow Alex. She's great on Twitter.
She's a rock star.
Really is.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to our fine sponsors.
That's right. Especially this an event apart one. These guys are doing good things, I've heard. And also to the Intuit Small Business blog, go to blog.intuit.com, campaignmonitor.com/worldview, and eventapart.com, Seldman.com.
There we are.
That's it. All right. Have a good one, everybody. We'll see you next week.